You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
They always say there's that fine line between a cop and a criminal. But you think about your life in general. I could have made a wrong turn somewhere in my life. By the grace of God, I didn't. But I definitely was not always on the right side of everything. It's just things just worked out to where I made the right way. And I think that's your career in general too, man. By the grace of God, you get through some situations.
Hey, gang. Welcome back to part two of this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Our guest this week is John Carr, 34-year veteran of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau, an ATF agent, retired now, spent most of that time of those, 34 years working undercover.
<That's old.
laughs> And you heard us yesterday. We talked about how he infiltrated the Mongols motorcycle gang, some of the other initial undercover investigations he did. And we talked about his nickname, Babyface, which everybody I know, and that's all the good guys, that's what they still refer to him as. They don't call him John Carr. But it turns out John has another nickname that he earned while he was working undercover. So, John, can you tell us a little bit about that and how you got it?
Yeah, again, like I say about nicknames, they're nicknames you don't get to pick for yourself, all right? Somehow you're given them. So keep that in mind. But yeah, during the Mongols investigation, like what was I always found so interesting about these types of the biker organizations is a lot of these guys don't even know what each other's real name is. They just know each other by their road name or moniker, as you would call it. And they have no idea what their real names are. So we did the Mongols infiltration. I don't know if I explained to you, but there's a process, right? And part of the process is you fill out an application. And it's a very lengthy application. It's like 4 pages long. And it's the basic stuff, your name, date of birth, social security number. I mean, it's very detailed. You had to list like the last past addresses you lived at for the past 10 years. If you went to elementary school, middle school, high school, if you were in the military, if you're ever in prison, you had to give 3 relatives their names, addresses, phone numbers that they could contact. Obviously, any vehicles, your motorcycle registration, all that stuff. And then they had a PI that would look at that stuff. But one of the lines on the application on the very front top was your road name that you want to be known by, your moniker, so to speak. And so I think I kind of mentioned, like when Billy Queen infiltrated, his moniker was Slow Brain Billy. Now, Billy may not admit this. And if I'm wrong, Billy, I apologize because that's what I've always heard. So if I'm wrong, brother, you can beat me up later. But I remember thinking to myself, if I am going to infiltrate the Mongols, I is damn sure going to pick a name, a road name that I think is cool. Like I'm not going to get stuck with something. So be that as may, I was a big Guns N' Roses fan. I didn't remember ever hearing a Mongol being known by Slash, the moniker Slash, which was the lead guitarist for Guns N' Roses. So I thought, man, I'm going to tell him I want to be called Slash. And I came up with this whole story why Slash was my nickname, blah, 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 blah. So before that even came to fruition, when I first started hanging out with the Mongols, I was in Colorado, out in Denver. They had what they call the biker swap meet. It's the largest biker swap meet event in the country, right? And so all the big clubs go to this event. They would hold it at that time at the convention center out in Colorado. And so the Mongols would make a big showing there. The Hells Angels, Sons of Silence, I think the Bandidos would go there. But what would happen is these clubs would go there and they would set up booths and sell their club paraphernalia, shirts and support and all that crap. And then normal people would go too, right? Because there would be bikes on display and all this. But like the Mongols always had a mission when they went there. It was just a show of force. And so we would go out there. They had security, obviously, at the venue. They had magnetometers, right, making sure people aren't carrying guns and stuff. And so what we would do is we would take our guns and whatnot, and we would hide them in the boxes of T-shirts and hats and the paraphernalia, and that's how we would get them around the security, right? And so then once we got into the venue ourselves, we take the guns out and put them on. And then the Mongols would do, as a mass, they would walk around the venue, just a show of like, hey, here we are type of deal. And we would always end up where the HAs were at. And then it would just always end up in like this verbal, fuck you, blah, blah, blah. And I remember telling Ciccone, the Cadence agent, I was like, hey, dude, this is going to be Laughlin 2.0. Like, this is where something's going to happen. Because it's just a recipe for disaster. And I just remember thinking that the couple of times that I went and worked, I was like, something bad's going to happen here. Luckily, it didn't. Luckily, it didn't. Years later, I will say this, the Mongols at that same event got into a shooting, stabbing with a club called the Iron Order, which was a quasi-law enforcement club. At that event, same thing happening. That's a whole nother topic. We can talk about law enforcement clubs on my opinion about that. But anyway, that's what happens at this event. Well, at this event was when I first was exposed to a member. We called him Freebird. He was a president of the Indiana chapter. When you first meet guys, they want to know who you are and where you're from and blah, blah, blah. And so I first meet this dude and I'm like, yeah, I'm originally from Southern California, which is what my backstory was, right? I was living in Vegas, but I was telling everybody I was still connected, originally from Southern California. So he's breaking my balls. He's like, yeah, you look like you're one of those Hollywood types that you'd be from Hollywood. He says that word, right? Hollywood. So pretty soon people are like, Hollywood, Hollywood. So these assholes start calling me Hollywood, Hollywood. So he keeps playing up on it. And so when he's telling me, he's like, yeah, you look like one of those pretty boys from Hollywood. And so he goes, as a matter of fact, and keep in mind, I just met this guy. He goes, tonight, I want you to come back to my place. He goes, I want you to fuck my old lady while I watch. And I'm like thinking to myself, okay, I literally just met this dude. I mean, obviously, I say all the time, I'm in law enforcement. I'm not going to do anything that's going to jeopardize, compromise the investigation. I said, number two, I had no idea what this guy's old lady looked like. So I'm just I'm doing everything I can to dance around that proposition he put out there. But him saying Hollywood, it just stuck. So pretty soon, everybody there called me Hollywood. Hey, Hollywood. So when it came time for me to fill out my application, I put slash and I gave a story. And I remember I'm in like this church meeting with all the members, right? And they're like, hey, what do you want to be known by? And so I give the whole slash story. And I remember we called him Big J. He ended up being the sergeant arms of my chapter. He stands me. He's like, no, you're Hollywood. That's what everybody knows you as. You don't get to change your name. You're going to be Hollywood. I get stuck with Hollywood. And I remember years down the road, I was reading one of the blogs we got outed on. And some guy wrote in there, he goes, you guys should have known better. Any asshole that goes by the road name of Hollywood should not be trusted. That's the worst name you could have. And you know what? Oh, he was right. He was right.
That's a lot different than Slash.
Yeah, dude, that was Hollywood, I guess. And there was a problem because Doc Ruben Cavazos was upset that too many guys were using the same road names. So we had too many dopeies, too many sleepies, too many sneezies. So he wanted everybody to be unique. So believe it or not, there was some other knuckle that had the moniker of Hollywood in the club. So I had to be called J Hollywood because there was some other guy clown that had Hollywood. So I couldn't even be Hollywood. They still call me Hollywood because I never barely even saw that other dude around. But yeah,
it just sticks. Yeah,
the names you get stuck with, and you're dead.
So let me ask you, now you've been working undercover for a while. Was there ever a time when you thought that the real John Carr had disappeared and your new undercover identity had become the real person?
I'll be honest, like certain roles you can get wrapped up in them, and not maybe just the roles. I think maybe like just in the undercover in general. I know other people have said this. It's like anything else. When you come on the job, right? I was like a lot of guys, right? I thought, hey, I'm going to make this legacy for myself, right? I'm going to work all these great cases and do all this great, and like somehow in the end, the name John Carr is going to ring out in the halls of ATF. That's utter bull. I say this all the time, man. I said this at my retirement. I realized that I was chasing a legacy that does not exist. At the end of the day, your legacy is your kids, your family. That's your legacy. I said, when I'm laying on my deathbed, it's not going to be the director of ATF standing next to me. I mean, hopefully it'll be my family who'll be there. But I got trapped in that where I thought doing all this stuff was the most important thing. And so I think not so much the roles, just the undercover persona itself. I just was so wrapped up into it that that's what all I thought about. And I remember like coming home, being gone on a project, maybe gone for 4 months, coming home, your kids, your wife, they just want you to do normal stuff, right? You're back home. I'll be like, hey, so-and-so, the neighbors are like, they're having a barbecue. They want you to go. And I'd be like, dad, that's the last place I want to go. And I said this to my neighbors. I have phenomenal neighbors. I'm the worst neighbor in my neighborhood. If I had me as a neighbor, I would be kicking the shit out of me every day. The worst neighbor in this neighborhood, hands down. And so I'd be like, no, I have no desire to do that. I just want to sit on the couch and watch TV. And then my phone rings and it's like somebody called me, hey, man, can you come out and do this deal? I couldn't grab my fast enough and run out the door to go do something else because that just, my brain was just wired in that mode, man. That's all I thought about. And so I always say it's the grace of God. My kids turned out good. My neighbors raised everybody, my wife, everybody raised them but me. And I tried to make a conscious effort to be, you know, to be back and be here, be there for stuff. Cause I always say your kids, they don't give a shit what you do for work, right? They don't care if you arrest 100 guys, whatever you're doing. They just want you there for what's important. Their practices, their ball games, school, stuff that matters. Cause that, you know, birthdays that you don't get back when you miss it. One of my sons to this day, he's like, you missed my birthday on this year. And I'm like, I don't think I did. He's like, no, you did. Like that's what they remember. And so, I just did a poor job in that area. I just got so, and I said, I'm saying something that a million guys have said. Well, you've probably heard it from all these guys. It's just, I think we get wrapped up in that. That stuff's important. And when it's over, it's over. And then you're just a regular.
When I retired from DEA, you know, you talk to the kids and we had 4 kids and later in my career, I thought I did a pretty good job at making it to some of high school events and soccer games and, you know, all the things that the recognition ceremonies and all that. And what they remember is all the stuff you missed. It was amazing. And I'm just amazing. Thinking, wow, I really was a jerk.
No, cause you remember the stuff you made, right? Like you're like, hey, I made that. You don't remember the shit you missed. And they're the complete reverse. They don't remember anything you made. They just remember the stuff that you didn't make it to. And and like I said, I don't think it's a cautionary tale for everybody. I just think it's a lot of guys and you are in that group. It's just something that I don't know how you get around that. I mean, if I could go back and I don't have regrets because I think regrets are pointless, but I don't think I could go back and change the John Carr of old back then. I just don't think he would listen. If this John Carr went back in time and be like, hey, like you need to get your head out of your ass and not, and be home. I think he'd be like, yeah, okay, whatever. Like, nah, I think that dude was just in a different mindset.
Understand completely. Understand. Were you ever suspected or accused of being an undercover cop?
I think so. I mean, I think just in general, guys will be like, something is not right about you or whatever. But, they still went through with it. I think red flags were there sometimes. And I always say about criminals, I mean, the smart guys are the smart guys, right? If they're on to you, you're not going to get over on them. They're going to be. But as a whole, I always say greed is what overrides their logic. And so there may have been things, red flags there where they know, but man, they can't pass that opportunity up for the money. And so, it's just the way it is.
That's, we capitalize on the greed and ego of these criminals.
Absolutely. And that's as a good undercover. You play to that. You play to that all the time. But I mean, being called out. I don't know that I'm trying to think. I mean, I've had instances of things that I probably should have been called out on that just were They just didn't like I remember like in, remember in the old days, like you would wear the body wires where you tape it up, the mic and the antenna, the old style,
the old
right?
KEL units.
Yeah, the old KEL units, right? And you'd be hot and the tape would wear away. I remember I was wearing, I was a knuckle and known to wear tight shirts. And so you could see the tape broke away and the mic just like there's a crease where the wire is sticking out. And I'm talking to the guy and he's looking at me. He's like, what the is that? And I'm like looking at him. I'm like, I don't know. It's like a wrinkle in my shirt. And I'm like trying to rub the tape back on to put the mic back on. Just stupid. Like that.
Oh,
one time, man. I had a 5-shot, and I had it in my waistband, just tucked in my waistband, and my pants. I don't know what it got loose or whatever, and so the 5-shot slips through my pants and goes down my leg, and I'm talking to the crook, and it slides all the way down and ends up on the top of my shoe. We're talking, and he looks down and he goes, "Hey, man, your strap, it slid down your pant." I'm like, "Oh, man, my bad." Pull my gun out, put it back in my waistband. But I mean, there have been times when I was told and the guys love to break my balls about this because it's on video, but told to take off our shirts. And not so much that they're just accusing me specifically of being a cop, but they just in general want to be like, "Hey, let's take our shirts off and make sure nobody's wearing a wire." So I got some great videos actually in the Mongols case. When I first, the chapter I ended up being a member of, they threw me for a loop, man. We were at the Silverton Casino and I was doing this street theater of like staging this cocaine transaction, and out of the blue, man, we get in there and they want to search me for a wire. I take off my shirt, they're patting me down. They think we're still wearing old school. But then there's that video of me with my shirt off that these dudes never let me forget. The best one was, it was me and my partner, Darren Kozlowski. We're in a motel room meeting these 8-tray gangster Crips on one of those robbery crew cases. And we get in the room and there's the two of us and there's 1, 2, 3, 4 of them in this little motel room. As soon as we get in there, the dude's like, one of the dudes is like, "Hey man, I just got back from prison. I'm coming up out of my, I ain't going back." So he takes his shirt off. And so the other guys take their shirt off. So I think, hey, we're just going to lift our shirts up, right? And show that we're not wearing anything. So I lift my shirt up and he's like, nah, come up out of that. And so I take off my shirt. And I always like to joke when I tell people, like, the camera legit makes you look 10 pounds heavier. So when I'm showing, I'm like, that's really not me, okay? But I tell people, when you see yourself on camera with your shirt off, you get motivated to work out. All of a sudden, you're like, I need to go to the gym. But I was lucky where I was sitting in the room. I was sitting on the bed, right? So I could lean back on the bed. When you lay back, your stomach flattens out, right? So I could lay back on the bed and flatten my stomach out so I didn't look so fat on camera. But my partner, he had nowhere to hide, man. He took his shirt off. And so at one point, we're talking, and I'm like looking for my partner. I'm like, where the fuck is he? And I look, and he's over on the other side of the bed, and he's crouched down behind the bed like this because he knows where the cameras are in the room. And so he's hiding to be off camera. I'm like, that mother. But it's like one thing I will say about that, though, is like 2 points. Is like, number one, one of the biggest downfalls for undercovers long-term is when you get complacent, especially when you've been dealing with somebody or an organization for a long time and you get doing deal after deal, deal after deal. And then so pretty soon you get trapped into like, okay, man, these dudes, I got not a worry in the world. And I always say the moment I said this to Ciccone one time when we were going to do with that street theater with the Mongols, I've been dealing with these guys for years. And he's like, "Hey, aren't you worried that it could be a robbery?" I'm like, "Not going to happen, dude." And I said these exact words. I said, "I got these guys eating out of the palm of my hand." And I always say this now, the moment you say that is the exact moment you don't. And that's when that'll flip the script on you. And that's when they did the whole searching thing. It blew my mind. Like with the 8-tray gangster Crips, like one things I say is like when you wear a gun, right, as a UC, but you want to keep it concealed, right? You don't want to let them know you're wearing a gun. But when you got to take your clothes off, there ain't no hiding your gun. The gig's up. And I remember with those guys, when they took my shirt off, I had my gun in my waistband. So there's no hiding it. So I remember I pulled it out. And I'm like, "Hey, this doesn't bother you guys, does it?" And I laid it on the bed in front of me. And as soon as I said that, they're like, "Oh, no." And they're all pulling their guns out. "Man, I got this." You know? So it obviously, I tell UCs all the time, if your gun does get discovered, exposed, or whatever, you can explain it away. Every swinging dick out there has got a gun on. And so it's not the end of the world, but do you want to give it up? Absolutely not. But sometimes it just happens. But my point, the lesson learned from all this, Steve, is the camera makes you look heavier. Okay. It's the truth.
That's the important thing.
Yeah.
Are there any sounds or smells that will take you right back to your undercover days now?
Yeah. I don't know what it was, but there's just like, obviously, like in the Mongol's case, your cut, your chaleco, your vest, it just has that leather, that smell, man. Mine's somewhere in my closet on the floor. But yeah, it's just that same old unique smell, just certain things, you know? Yeah. I don't know if it's so much that smells and just locations, places you've been. It's weird. Like I say, the farther I get away from my retirement and I look back on my career, things that we did and I've done, part of me is, man, I don't know what drove me to do that at that time. Like kind of going to the point where you said about being exposed as a undercover. I remember it wasn't so much me per se, but I was doing this case on the East Side Rivas, which was a big Hispanic gang in Riverside. The main guy was a Mexican mafia guy. Long story short, I got into him from an informant. I was buying from a member. We turned that member, right, and made him our informant. And he was gold mine. He led me to the hierarchy, to the top, man. We're buying guns and dope. We smashed their gun supplier. It was a beautiful thing. Well, somewhere as we're getting towards the end, he got compromised and he got outed on Facebook as being an informant. And I was literally, the Facebook posting came up right as I was briefing to go meet the main guy at his tire shop. He had a tire shop, the Mexican mafia guy. I was literally talked to him on the phone and said, hey, I'll be there in like 20 minutes. And so we were briefing up and the posting comes up and the case agent showed me, he's like, hey, dude, we got a problem. And our guy just got outed as an informant. And that he's bringing around a DEA guy. I was like, and I remember that agent Darren Kozlowski was there, part of the cover team. He was there with me. And so they're telling me that. And I was like, I just talked to the guy. I got to go. Like, if I don't go show up, it's the gig's up. Like, he'll definitely know something's up. And they're like, well, you can't risk him. And so I remember Darren pulling me aside, and saying this to me, and it just resonated with me. He goes, you know what the problem with you? He goes, you have no regard for your own safety. And man, I'm thinking, when he said that, I'm thinking, coming from him, who I consider one of the most wild dudes on the planet when it comes to doing undercover, and he's telling me that I have no regard for my own safety. And I was like, man, have I become that guy that just doesn't give a f-? Like, I was like, man, I was like, dude, I don't think that's me. And he's like, dude, I'm not saying it right now, but I'm saying you need to think about it. And so I finally got them to concede and let me go. I didn't go into the shop. I just parked out like in the driveway. And I said, hey, if he walks out towards me and I get like a weird vibe, like something's up, I'll just get in my car and leave. And it ended up working out, but it's just like things I'll think about that, you know, going by a tire shop and just, it'll bring me back to that moment, just like locations and spots. And they ended up being violent dudes. They ended up whacking a dude right after that case, right at the next yard of the tire shop. And so, yeah, these were super violent dudes. I just was afraid. Maybe you do get caught up in roles and stuff that you just, those warning signs that are there and you don't see them. That's why it is good to have, you know, maybe we used to do it more on a formal basis, but like you kind of have that outlet. Like if you're a UC, you got another guy that's kind of like your outlet that you can talk to, and he'll be that voice of reason for you when you need it. Cause sometimes you need that. And you can get lost in these moments because you get the blinders on.
That you need that voice of reason to bring you back to reality.
You do, man. Because sometimes you get lost in the moment, man. And I'm sure we're all guilty of that, man. You're so hell bent on like, this guy, I'm going to put this dude in jail. And then that's all you're thinking about.
What do you think is the biggest misconception that most Americans have about these outlaw motorcycle gangs?
I just think they get kind of, you know, like they're the good guys. Like they're just some good guys. And I'm not trying to paint every, you know, OMG member with a broad brush and just expect they're all criminals. Cause there's a lot of guys in the clubs that are not criminals. Okay. But I always said this about the Mongols. And I think this goes with a lot of these OMGs. It's like, you may be a legit guy. You may have a legit job. You may not have no criminal history. But when you put that patch on, there's a level of expectation from you that goes beyond the normal bounds of society that are just not governed by that. And so you got to be prepared for that. And I'll tell you a quick story on that note. I was teaching at a gang conference up in Utah about the Mongols. And when I got done, this sergeant from Salt Lake City PD comes up to me after and he goes, "Hey, you know what? That hit really close to home." I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "My brother is a Mongol up in Utah." And he goes, and he had like a legit job. I can't remember. It was like plumber or electrician or something. Legit. He goes, he just gravitates to that life, that outlaw lifestyle. And he goes, "What do you foresee as a problem?" And exactly what I just told you, I told him, I said, "Dude, the problem I see is once he puts that cut on, there's going to be expectations. Like if they go to war with the HAs, you don't get to be like, nah, time out. I'm a normal guy. No, you're wearing that patch. Guess what? You're going. You're one of us." Fast forward, I don't know, it was 3-4 years. The Mongols are having a national run down in Mexico. So chapters are riding down there from everywhere. There was two Mongols coming down through San Bernardino. I think it's the 15 or 215 that goes through there. Anyway, one of their bikes breaks down. So on the side of the freeway, the two Mongols, a car pulls up, slows up, gun comes out, boom, 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 kills one of the Mongols. Guess who that Mongol was?
That guy's brother.
That cop's brother. So it's just like that patch, wearing that patch gets you killed. I mean, he's just a normal dude. So I just think that's the misconception. A lot of the people, they just think, there's some normal dudes in there, but it's different once you become a member. And I'm not saying every dude in there is slinging dope or running guns or whatever, but it's like when violence happens, you're going to be a part of it if you're there. There's no sitting it out. I always say about the Mongols and any OMG and ever, you're never going to fight them one-on-one. It's going to be 1-on-5, 1-on-10, whoever's there, because that's the expectation. If you and I are Mongols, Steve, and you get in a fight and I'm with you, guess what? I'm in that fight with you. There's no sitting out. And I don't care if there's 15 of us. That's just the way it's going to be. So I just think that people just don't see that. Man, it's just a different world they live in. And they proudly live in it. They proudly live in it.
Now, you've received a lot of recognition and awards throughout your career for some of the unfrickin' believable things that you were involved with. But twice you were recognized by the Federal Bar Association with the Medal of Valor. Can you tell us, I think you told me one's 1995 and the other was in 2002. Can you tell us, give us the Reader's Digest version on what those awards were about?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, about awards and accolades and all that stuff, man, I always say this, like, and I say this to the new guys coming on. If you do this job for awards and accolades, you're going to be highly disappointed because it's never about that, man. It's just about what means more to me than any award is a guy like you telling me, "Hey, man, that was a good case you did." Or one of my buddies tell me that's better than any award you could ever get from anybody. But do I appreciate any award I got? Absolutely. Those Medal of Valors were here in LA. The one in the 90s was because of a shooting we got involved in. There was a back in the 90s, as I mentioned, it was big. Crips and Bloods were big going on. And there was a case where this Crips set was trafficking crack cocaine out to Colorado. Long story short, it was worked jointly ATF, FBI. They had an arrest warrant for the one member. His name was Daryl Mason. And so we were going to effect the arrest at his apartment complex out in West LA. And I always joke about it now. I think it was an FBI arrest warrant. We only had one FBI agent out there. It was all ATF people out there. And so long story short, we were sitting in a van, the four of us, the arrest team, right outside his apartment complex. And the plan was, and looking back on it, a horrible plan we had. We had an informant who was going to pull up in his car, call him on his phone. He was there to buy a pound of rock, crack cocaine. And so he was going to have Mason come outside the complex to his car and do the transaction out by his car. We're going to do a jump out of the van and effect the arrest right there on the street by the informant's car. The informant was wired up, which was great because I got the audio recording of the whole thing. And so the informant shows up, calls him. Mason's like, "Just come up to the apartment." And he's like, "Nah, man, I'm in a hurry. Just come down to my car." And that's red flag number one. He didn't do business like that. You go to his place. Now, all of a sudden, you know, he wants him to come down to his car. So he knew something wasn't right. And I remember I could see him. He would come out to the stoop of his apartment complex, and he's standing there, and he can see the informant's car right down the street. And he's telling the informant, like, come up. And the informant's like, nah, come to me. You know, so he knows something's not right. So he goes back up to his apartment complex, to his apartment unit. And there was another gang member there with him. His name was Victor Pugh. We didn't know that at the time, but now we had the adjacent unit, like a couple agents in the adjacent unit listening, and they could hear them talking and very agitated, like something was up. So next thing we know, we're looking, the apartment complex sat over they had like a subterranean garage with a security gate. And so we could see him down in the garage, him and Victor Pugh, and they're at the trunks of their cars. They had two 5.0 Mustangs souped up, and they were parked right next to each other. One was pulled in, and one was backed in. They're at the trunk of one of them, the red one, and they got it open. And so the decision was like, hey, if the security gate opens up, like they're going to whatever, the arrest team jump out, run down the garage, affect the arrest in the garage. Okay, cool. Well, it happened to be the apartment manager. We see him. We didn't know it was the apartment manager. We see this white guy down in the garage. And what he was doing was he's giving him a new clicker for the garage opener. So he's showing him how it works. So boom. He hits it. The gate opens up. Initiate. Boom. We jump out. And so my training officer was number one. I was number two behind him. We had three and four. Four of us running the garage. And so we're running the garage. We're yelling, police, get on the ground. They're still fucking around at the trunk of one of the cars. And it's like a lot of guys have been in shootings and they say, hey, everything slows down. Absolutely. It slows down because we're yelling, police, get on the ground. And I remember looking at Daryl Mason, and he like turns from the trunk, and he has I later found out it's a full auto Mac 11, and he turns and he just like opens up, lets it rip, man. And it's like, it's slow motion. Like you could just see the, like almost like the discharge from the firearm. And I tell people all the time, man, your body instinctively runs for cover. Like you go. And so we, all of a sudden the four of us disperse. Right. And so I went behind a pillar. The other three and four went to the right because there are vehicles. They staged behind the vehicles. Number one guy was this senior guy named Mike Dawkins. Phenomenal guy. He loved carrying the Remington 870 back then, which was the short-barreled, the pump-action shotgun. And so he's pumping off some rounds, but he has nowhere to run for cover because he's the first guy in there. So he's literally running by those two guys, pumping rounds at him, and they're obviously – Mason turns on him and he gets hit. I didn't know where he got hit. He ended up getting hit in the foot. And so he goes down. And so my instinct was like, oh man, I know he's down. So you're trying to lay cover fire. And I remember like I could hear the rounds hitting the pillar. Right. And so we're exchanging gunfire with him. And what the bizarre thing about it was, I'm looking like in my mind, I'm like, I know we're hitting this guy. I could see it because he's scampering now. And he's like, you know, shooting under his arm as he's trying to get in between the cars. And I'm like, why is this dude not going down? And so he goes between the cars and disappears. So I moved from cover because I was seeing if Mike was okay, but I knew Mike was okay. I think I told you this earlier when I saw him roll over on his back and he pulled the SIG out and he's shooting between his legs. So I'm like, okay, this dude, he's still in the fight.
He's still
engaged. So long story short, another agent, Chuck Pratt, who is now, God rest his soul, deceased, he came in the garage and he had a Remington 870. So him and I end up cornering Mason. The other guy, Victor Pugh, gave up immediately. He had a pistol in his hand. He dropped it and went to his hands and back head to a pillar. How that dude did not get hit in any crossfire is a miracle, the number of rounds that were thrown in that garage. But he gave up. But Chuck and I ended up cornering Daryl Mason. He was trying to go between the cars on the backside of the wall, and Chuck hit him twice with double op buck, and that was it. That was it for that dude. But anyway, it was that shooting that they gave that award for. But like I said, man, our plan initially wasn't the soundest plan, but things are fluid. You just got to figure it out on the fly, you know, how it goes when it works. Nobody gets hurt. Nobody gets killed. I mean, that's obviously, you don't want to see any of your brothers get hurt and get through that thing.
Well, you know, there's no saying that the best laid plans, you can have every contingency planned out. As soon as you initiate, it goes right out the window. Nobody gave a copy of the plan to the bad guys.
No. Doesn't Mike Tyson always say, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face? And that's the truth. You just don't know until you go. And so I think that really kind of carries over in your, in undercover too, man. You can plan everything, right? As best you can. But I tell people all the time, I guarantee you, your deal is not going to go exactly how you want it to go. And so you got to have some fluidity to how you operate, because it's just not. But with that said, you also got to know when enough is enough. And I think that's where you can get trapped, because it just, you know, something could go wrong. You know, to walk away is the hardest part. When something is not right, to walk away is the hardest part, because you get so trapped, you want it to go.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here. And we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Was there ever, through all your undercover dealings, was there ever a person that either you liked or respected so much that you actually tried to save them to get them out of that line? I mean, maybe with, probably without divulging who you really were.
I mean, I don't know that I, let me think about that. It wasn't, I mean, I think of a couple instances. Obviously in the Mongols case, like I said, there were guys that were legit. I mean, they were good guys outside the scope of them being dope traffickers. They were really loyal guys. Yeah. Did I have some heartache about them getting arrested? I felt bad about it. Absolutely. But at the end of the day, like I said, you got to know where that line is. There's no tipping your hat and being, because obviously you're not going to compromise anybody's investigation, your safety. You got other undercovers. I mean, that's just not going to happen. But do you feel bad about it? Yeah. Yeah, you do. I remember one time I was doing this robbery crew and my informant, this was gang up in Stockton. And one of the guys that was part of the robbery crew was the informant's cousin. And so I'm trying to tell the informant, I'm like, listen, man, you got to figure out a way to get your cousin out of this, because it's not going to end good for him. I'm like, because he was going to be part of the robbery crew, that we're going to end up arresting him. And I said, I don't know how to, well, you're going to have to figure out some, steer him clear. Ended up, he showed up. He gets arrested. And obviously the informant, his relationship with that family was ruined because he got exposed. But I mean, it's just things like that. You can try, but at some point you can't, there's only so much you can do. And people choose the paths that they chose, man. You know, and you wish they hadn't, but you can only hope maybe it's a lesson or something, but I mean, not always the case.
Well, you know, we try to teach our children, for every decision you make, there's a consequence, good or bad. You know, so before you make those decisions, you might want to give some consideration to the consequences if things don't go the way you want them to, because it's that's what happens a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's true, man. It's just, it's actually just a sad state of affairs, man. There's some people, like I said, they, for whatever reason, that's the choice they make. And it's like, they always say there's that fine line between a cop and a criminal. But you think about your life in general, I could have made a wrong turn somewhere in my life. By the grace of God, I didn't, but I definitely was not always on the right side of everything. It's just, things just worked out to where I made the right way. And I think that's your career in general too, man. By the grace of God, you get through some situations.
That's the truth. Let's switch over and do a little rapid fire here. These are designed to be one word answers, two word answers. If you want to expound on any of them, you're more than welcome to.
Okay.
First one up, coffee or energy drinks?
Energy drinks. Drinking one right as we speak. I wish, although I'll say this, Steve, I wish I liked coffee. I do. I wish I did. I would probably drink it by the buckets full because I'm a caffeine freak, but I just never acquired the taste for it. And my dad was a coffee nut. It would be 110 degrees outside and we'd be stopping to get a hamburger and fries and he'd order a hot cup of coffee. And I just never got around that, man.
Yeah, I love coffee, but not like that.
Oh, yeah, that's a diehard.
How about a Harley or an Indian motorcycle?
I would say Harley.
most underrated firearm?
Ooh, underrated firearm. I don't know if it's underrated, but I was always a SIG guy. I loved when we went to the SIG and then we went away from it and went to the Glock and now different variations of the Glock. But I always loved the SIG, man. I shot the SIG great. I don't, and I, like I said, I don't, I assume it's a popular gun. Believe it or not, I'm the furthest thing from a gun stroke that you'll ever meet, man. I didn't own a gun before I came on this job and had to buy a gun when I came got off the job because I didn't own any personal guns.
Yeah, I like the SIGs. They're very sweet.
Yeah, but you being a West Virginia guy, you probably grew up with guns. You probably
Just a hunting rifle and a shotgun. That was it.
Although I remember as a kid, though, my dad had guns, some handguns and stuff. And my brothers and I, the one that's the FBI agent, myself, we would take his guns out of his dress drawer and take them out back and shoot them. We had no business what we were doing. We'd be shooting his guns off out in the, we lived out in the country, man, out in the woods shooting them. God, I would kill my kids when they were young if they ever did that.
All right. How about the best ATF office?
Ooh. Now, are we talking division or like this little office locate? Are you talking about like location? Division or?
Location.
Oh, location? I mean, for work, LA. I mean, because I'm biased. I've been here, right? I just, every kind of work you could possibly want. As far as like location, like living, ooh, that's a good one. I mean, I've been out to Denver a lot. Colorado's nice. Denver's nice. I'm not a super winter guy, though. I don't know how I would fare in the winters, though, I'll be honest.
How about the best biker bar food?
Biker bar food.
And beer does not count.
No. I mean, pretty much biker bar foodie. You know, so I don't know if there's anything I would quantify as great or good. Maybe a burger. I mean, I don't know, man.
How about the weirdest tattoo?
The weirdest tattoo. I think the old school, you see some of these guys, remember the old school tattoos that would be like keep on trucking and it has the character. Well, I mean, but there are some goofy tattoos out there that some guys get that you just, it boggles me. I mean, when we did the Black Rain takedown, the guy, some of the Mongols were getting like the Black Rain, like an ATF line through it. Like, oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know why the they would want to get that. Blows my mind. But yeah, it's just, some people get some crazy stuff. I always say about tattoos, man, it's like, I didn't have any ink all through the Mongols case, not a stitch. And I didn't get any of my ink until that case was over. I'll tell you honestly why I didn't. It was because of my mom. My mom was anti-tattoo. It's crazy the power our mothers have over us. And so I would not do it because she was so against tattoos. Well, then, you know, as my mom got older, her memory was going and whatnot. And my sons, we all go to the same tattoo artist. My older son, he went to the artist and he got a sleeve done. And so he went up with his girlfriend to see my mom. And so when he came back, I said, "Hey, man, did your grandma say anything about your tattoo?" He's like, "No, she didn't say one thing about it." I'm like, okay, cool. So as time would go by, I worked on my sleeve and I got my sleeve done, figuring my mom's not even, she probably won't even notice or whatever. And man, I'll tell you, I walked in to see her and she zeroed in on that like a beacon. Like, and we are in like this assisted living facility, right? With nurses and stuff. And I walk in and like loud, she screams out, "What is that?" And she's pointing to my arm. And I'm like, oh man. So what do? I immediately go into the lie mode, right? I'm like, "Oh yeah, it's fake, mom. I got this for work, but it's fake. I can wash it off when I'm done." And like, at that time I was like 57, 58 years old, right? And so she hears me say that and she looks at me like I'm 6 years old again. "Go to the bathroom, wash it off right now." I'm like, and she's screaming this in front of all these nurses and stuff. And I'm like, what the hell is going on, you know? And so then I would finally, you know, I put a jacket on or whatever. And so I would go visit her again later, Groundhog Day. Walk in, zero in. "What is that?" I go to the same lie again. "Go wash it off." Like she just every time. Like my kids, my younger son, he got his sleeve done. Nope, says nothing to them. And so finally I went to her. I'm like, why are you so on me about me? She goes, and this is how her mind, the clarity that she still had. She's like, you're my son. Those are your sons.
Exactly.
Like, okay. Touche. Good point. But yeah, she like literally was against it. So I just, the whole tattoo thing, I thought really long and hard about what I was going to get when I did it because you have it. I mean, it's there. So I did the whole Asian theme, but some guys, I don't think they think about it in the moment, what they're doing when they get some of these tattoos, because some of them are just crazy. That guy in my chapter, Big J, he was the sergeant at arms. He had a marijuana leaf like on his stomach, right? And keep in mind, Big J is a big dude. He had a gigantic boiler. So that tattoo leaf, like if I put that on you, it probably would cover your whole upper body. Like, but on him, it looked like a postage stamp, like this little marijuana leaf. And so I just thought that was so funny. He would take his shirt off at parties and stuff. And I'd be like, dude, like that tattoo, it looks like a little stamp. Like you needed to do something bigger than that, you know? But like I said, if I put that tattoo on you, it would cover your whole upper body. Yeah. Bizarre.
How about, do you have any hidden talents?
I don't know if I have any talents. All right. So I don't think there's anything hidden. No, I definitely do not, man. I wish I did. I always laugh about my mom. She was so hell bent on one of us to learn how to play the piano. Right. And so we all got piano lessons and not one of us could play the piano to save our life. And it's like, God, if I just look back and took some things serious when I was a kid, yeah, maybe when you ask that question now, I could be like, oh, I could play classical music on the piano or like Japanese. Like I wish I had learned to speak Japanese. My mom obviously was fluent, you know, but keep in mind, she marries a hillbilly from West Virginia who's like, nah, we speak English in this house. And my mom, God bless her, she tried to send us to Japanese school, you know, to learn. And all we did was get in fights with the other Japanese kids because they knew we weren't 100%. So that went nowhere. Yeah, there's things I wish looking back I had taken serious because I could answer that question and be like, oh yeah, I got that. No hidden talents.
Hindsight's 2020, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How about one or two words describing ATF?
One or two words. I would say that like the people I knew that were part of my crew, man, were just hard workers. You wouldn't find a better group of guys, man. I surrounded myself with just the alpha dogs in ATF. And I really preach that to my kids. I say all the time, I was like, hey, my dad had an expression, and I'm sure you heard this, but I remember him saying it when I was young. He always used to say, hey, if you lie down with the dogs, you get up with fleas. And basically what it means is you're the company you keep, right? And so I was determined, like I knew my shortcomings coming in at agency. So I was like, I'm going to surround myself with the best undercover guys, the best tactical guys, the best cage agent guys. So somehow, like when they mention those guys' names and my name gets mentioned too, like, oh, man, it's part of them. But it's like, you want to be around those guys because all it is like you either keep up or you're going to get left behind. And so I think that's what motivates you when you surround yourself with others. So I tell my kids all the time, I'm like, hey, you know, when you choose your friends, when you go your careers, like when you're working, man, find the guy that's the number one guy and get next to him. Because A, you're going to learn from him, but B, you're going to be like, hey, that's the guy that's going to drive you. So it's like all the dudes, some of them you mentioned, the Chris Baylesses, the Lou Velos, the Jay Dobbins, the Darren Kozalskis, the John Ciccone's. I could go down the list. It's endless, right? The Tino Brancatos, the TFOs, all these guys are the alpha dogs of law enforcement. And those are the guys you want to be around for a couple of reasons. One, yeah, you're going to learn the job better. But two, when it hits the fan, those are the guys you want with you. And so it just kind of works hand in hand. So when you say, how do I describe ATF? Yeah, these I picked the hardworking, man. There's guys that just go at it, man. And still, I believe that's the mentality of ATF. Like the guy that they have as their director now, Bobby Sakata is that kind of guy. He's just that old school, just they got the right guy for ATF, man. So I'm thinking that that's a good thing for them.
You know, I met him 2 months ago in, where were we? Omaha. And he's agreed to come on the show. So he'll be a guest here on the show soon.
Have him. I mean, his backstory will be great, going from NYPD to obviously ATF and all they went through. But he's just, yeah, he'll be a phenomenal guy. Because like I said, man, they picked the right guy. And we don't say that all the time, right? We see people get management, right. And we're like, how the fuck did this person get there? Nah, they got the right guy.
How would you finish this sentence? If people knew the truth about undercover work.
If people knew the truth about undercover work, I think they would understand how important law enforcement really is to this country on what they do. Because you don't really understand what the criminal world is about unless you get a glimpse and see it from the inside, right? You can, a lot of the public, man, they just see things from the outside, right? They don't really know what the inside, how these guys think, how they operate. And I think if they got a chance to look at that, they would be like, man, thank God we got these agencies out there doing what they do. And they're the undercovers, like we say, man, they're the unsung, and I'm not including myself in this group, but these undercover guys and gals that we have, man, they're the unsung heroes because they're doing that nobody even hears about. It's just never heard about, man. It's just like, it's done. A case is made. Somebody or some people go to jail and they don't really know the backstory on what brought those people to there. So, I just think it's just that not been exposed.
Yep. I'm with you 100%. So why did you decide to finally retire from ATF?
You know how it goes, Steve. Like you max out at 57, right? And so I did, but then I extended. You can extend three times, right? And so I extended twice. And I remember I had an opportunity to extend a third time. And I had just finished, we did an undercover project in San Diego. So I was down there for 3 months. And I remember being back, and he's now retired. At the time, he was the, let's see, Mickey was like the, his name's Mickey French, a great guy. I think he was a deputy assistant director. He talks to me, goes, hey, why don't you extend a third time? And I was like, you know, Mickey, I would, but I don't think there's a reason for me to extend again. I extended the two times before because I had something going on, projects, work, things that I wanted to be there for. But like to extend again, just to extend, I was like, nah, I think I'm done, man. And I always say about retirement, when your time is there, and I felt it. And actually, I kind of got a little bit like a epiphany or like this moment in your career when you realize it's coming to an end. It's when I was doing that project in San Diego. And I remember, man, I was in the hood somewhere and it was like 11:30 at night and I'm in my UC car and I'm buying some dope from some gangster. His moniker was Lonely, believe it or not, how appropriate. But anyway, it's like 11:30 at night and it's kind of, the weather was kind of misty. And I remember thinking to myself afterwards, I'm like, what the f- am I doing, man? I'm like 58 years old or whatever. My kids are older than this dude sitting in my car. And then fast forward, that case led to, I was working my way up and we're getting to the source. And long story short, I was going to the actual trap house where the dude that was supplying all the dope for the neighborhood was. And I didn't know exactly what unit his pad was or where the dope was coming from, but I just remember doing all the deals outside. I would see everybody come out this security door and go up these stairs, and there's only two units at the top. And so I remember telling the case agent, I was like, hey, I'm just going to go up there cold. And I go, I'll figure out which unit is the one. I'm going to knock on the door. And man, I've been dealing with these guys. I'm going to drop the dude's names that I've been dealing with and get inside that way. And so I brought another UC with me. So I didn't go by myself. I brought another UC with me. His name was Fletch Ogg. Great guy. He's out of Flagstaff. And so we go, and I remember parking, walking up to the security door, and I see this OG gangster walk out, Hispanic dude. And he walks out. So when I see him walk out, I'm like, okay, I know we're definitely in the right spot. And so we go up the stairs, and I'm at the top of the stairs, and it's a real narrow stairway. And I'm at the top of the stairway, and I look – there's two drawers and they face each other like this. I look at the one on the right and it's got like six locks on it, and it's got like an actual business name on it, like some kind of towing or maintenance or something. So I know that's not it. The other door to the left, it's kind of open, ajar. And I'm like, this has got to be it. So I knock on the door. A female answers. I recognize the female because I would see her when I would do my deals. And so I asked for the two guys I'm looking for. One guy, we called him Paco. And she's like, nah, Paco, not here. And I'm like, what about this dude, Bones? No, Bones not here either. And so as I'm talking to her, I look down the stairwell and I see the security door open up. And the OG guy that walked out is walking back in. I look and I could see he's high as and he's got like a old Letterman's jacket on, a backpack. And I look and I could see that he's got a pistol out and he has it under his, inside his jacket. And he's got his pistol out under his jacket and he's looking up at me and he's like, who the f- are you? And so I'm like, oh. And so in that split second, I remember telling the other UC, cause he's in between in the stairwell. I was like thinking to myself, okay, like we're fixing to get in a gunfight, like right here in the stairwell. And so I remember telling him, I was like, dude, I'm gonna be honest with you. Like you were in a bad spot. I'm like, I had the high ground. I felt pretty comfortable. Like if this is going to go to go, you probably would have got caught hit with some friendly fire, man. But I said, I would have said a lot of good things about you afterwards when it was all said and done. But long story short, what I say about the gift of gab, right? So he's like, who are you? And so I'm like, hey, listen, man, I'm looking to get a re-up. I was looking for Paco, blah, blah, blah. Come to find out, Paco burned this dude because Paco was getting from him too. He's like, Paco burned me for 30 grand. So now I'm on the Paco bandwagon. I'm like, yeah, Paco, he was upcharging me too. So all this bullshit. So he puts his gun away, goes upstairs, and we end up doing the deal and whatever. But that's when I was like, I think it's a wrap. Like, I think it's time after this project's over. I've done everything. I don't, you know, it's like almost like you pushing the envelope. Like you're just going and going and going and going. And eventually, like all, like you kind of say, right? The grace of God, luck, whatever you want to say, those moments that you just get through it. And so that's when that was it. And I was like, I'm done. And I'm good with it. I'm totally good with it.
So what are you doing now?
You know, I do. I got a job back with the ATF teaching at the academy. And like I always tell, it's not about the money. It's just about the guys, right? I get to go back and see the guys because they come in to help teach. So that's cool. I do some of this executive protection stuff, just a side gig. My buddy has a contract. And then, you know, speaking stuff, I still do that. So yeah, I'm just, I find of things that keep me busy enough to keep me busy, but I'm going to talk to you afterwards. There's some things I want to talk to you about outside of all that.
Well, what, anything I can do, brother, anything.
Well, definitely. I'll be getting you. But yeah. So just enough to keep me busy.
At some point, if your grandchildren come and ask you about your career, how are you going to explain that to them?
You know, I think it's pretty simple. Just explain it in general terms. You're in law enforcement, and I don't think you got to get down into the weeds and explain all the nitty gritty details about exactly what I did. Just in generality, you're in law enforcement and fighting crime. I think at the end of the day, you know, the stories, like you and I can talk about them and share them and laugh and stuff because you get it. But I think I'm not a real big storyteller unless you're asked about it to do it, right? Just in general, talking to people. I always like said about like talking about my neighborhood, like, I was the worst neighbor in my neighborhood. And here's why. Like I would pull up in my neighborhood and I'd see my neighbors, the guys would be out talking and stuff. I'd park my car and just walk into my house. I wouldn't say one word to them. And it's not because they were bad guys or anything. It's just, I got trapped in that mindset. It's like, man, there's nothing me and these dudes are going to have in common to talk about.
Yeah.
and I fell into that trap. And they say that's a trap you shouldn't fall into, right? In this job, right? You should have friends outside of the scope of your job to be more balanced and blah, blah, blah. Not me. Every friend I had was on the job. And so I was just like, those are the guys that understand me. So it was, these guys are great guys. They're phenomenal dudes. I just didn't, in my mind, couldn't figure out how we're going to relate, you know? So you just fall into that kind of groove.
Well, after 34 years on the job, what is it that you miss and what is it you're thankful for that you'll never have to do again?
I mean, I miss the regular camaraderie, the guys, the constant being together on projects, being together on trainings, the smoking and joking. That's why I said the academy job's been a blessing in that regards. What I don't miss the politics side of it. What I mean by the politics side of it is like just the constant battling of getting your cases prosecuted and dealing with just because the judicial system is an ever evolving animal, right? With laws and what's allowed and what's not allowed. And so the longer you stay on this job, right, the more things change and you either evolve with it or you're one of those dinosaurs that just can't get with the program. And it's just constantly having to adjust how you work your cases and do things and just that constant battling. Because at the end of the day, what is the goal? The goal is people going to jail for committing crimes, right? You're not doing all this for and giggles. There's an end game to it. And so that's what you want to happen. That is the culmination of what you do. And so it's that constant battling with the attorneys and stuff and making sure it gets there. Hey, it is what it is, right? But judges and attorneys, they'll see things differently than how I'll see it. And you got to deal with that. Yeah, that's a shit I don't miss.
Well, God bless you because you're out there in the Ninth District where you never know what's going to happen.
The Ninth Circus is what it is. I had a judge out here. God rest his soul. His name was Manuel Real, Manny Real. He was appointed by Lyndon Johnson. That's how long he sat on the bench. He was in his 90s. He was in his 90s when he sat on the bench. I probably had 10 cases that he had of mine. Not that I appeared in front of him in any of those cases, but he had 10 cases of mine where I was either the primary undercover or the case agent. And I don't know what it is, man, but at the end of his career, I think he was 94 at the time. He's still sitting on the bench. And keep in mind, he was the most overturned judge in the Ninth Circuit. I had one of these robbery crew cases, and for whatever reason, man, he just had it in for me. And so he's reading the indictment in court, and he stops as he's reading the indictment, and he looks up and he goes, "Why isn't Agent John Carr in custody?" And so the AUSA is like, "Excuse me, Your Honor?" He's like, "Why is he not in custody with these guys?" And she's like, "Well, Your Honor, he's a federal agent. He's the undercover in this case." And he's like, "Well, he's the leader of this conspiracy. He should be indicted too." And so I remember the case agent calling me up and saying, "Hey, I don't think you should show up in court anytime soon in front of Manny Real because I think he'll lock you up." Like, he literally was just like he had lost it. He had literally lost his mind. And so I was like, man, if I should ever appear in front of this guy, I think he would lock me up. Oh, but it's just like that kind of stuff, man.
I'm sitting here laughing because when I came back from South America, I was stationed in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I was there 3.5 years and just rocking and rolling. And there was a judge over in Winston-Salem, federal judge, who was in his late 80s, early 90s, senior judge in the Middle District. And he would come up with some of the most outrageous sayings. And of course, the prosecutors would object, and he would stop and he'd look at his clerk and say, "What'd he say? Can I do that?" He's going to this clerk to get his judicial ruling.
Get legal advice.
Yeah. I'm thinking, man, it's time for you to go.
The lifetime appointment thing is a whole different thing. I mean, I had this one judge, I was in trial and I'd be sitting on the stand, right? Testifying. Right. And then there'd be a sidebar. Right. So he would slide his chair over when the attorneys would come around the sidebar, and any good agent that's worth his weight is trying to listen in and glean some intel on what's going on in the sidebar. Right. And so I'm trying to see if I could pick up some chatter to see what the issue is. Right. And so what he would do is he would go over to the sidebar and he would take his name placard and he would hold it in front of his mouth. Right. So as he was speaking, because he thinks like the jurors are reading his lips, but keep in mind, he's speaking so loud, the whole courtroom can hear what he's saying. And so one of these times he slides over and they're at sidebar and he's got his placard up in front of his mouth and he's looking at me as he's talking, right? Looking deadpan at me. And I can hear clear as day. He's like, "Yeah, that Agent Carr, he's a damn cowboy. I'm tired of his antics." I can hear him like you and I are talking right now. I'm like, "You don't need the placard up in front of your mouth, all right? Everybody heard what you just said." I mean, he just did not like me, dude. He did not like me at all. And you just can't get around that stuff. You can't.
Well, there's one final question that I ask every guest, and that is, do you have any words of wisdom or advice for anyone that's considering a career in law enforcement or the military or a high-risk occupation?
I would say this, you know, it's like, especially in today's day and age, man, just know what you're getting into, right? I'm all for it. Believe me, I think we need good people in all those employment opportunities, military, law enforcement, but know what you're stepping into and realize what it's all about, because, you know, understanding, because I think a lot of people, you know, they may get into these careers based off of past relatives, fathers, uncles, whatever, and hearing their stories on how it was, and just know, like, it's different. What it is today is not how it was 20 years ago, 15 years ago. So just understand that going into it, and really just looking out, find that brotherhood of people and just look out for each other. Because, I mean, I know a lot of it said, Steve, and you can agree or disagree with me on this point, but I know there's been that changing mindset of like us saying it's no longer us against them, you know, and that mentality, you got to get away from that. To me, it's us against them. It was that way 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago. It'll be that way 50 years from now. To me, I just don't think you can get away from that mindset. It's us against them. And if that's how you go forward, and I'm not saying using that mantra or that mindset as a way to do anything bad. It's just, that's how it is. That's the way they think. That's the way the criminal world thinks. And so I just think we got to understand what it is. Let's quit trying to dance around it and dress it up like it's something other than it is. It's us against them. And just know that.
You know, and you look at a criminal organization, that they look at that just like you said. And if ever they want to come to us, it's because they want to pay us money to be corrupt, to help them out in their criminal enterprise. It's not that they want to be friends with you.
Nope. That's all it is, man. I mean, all that stuff is in that criminal world, man. It all boils down to money. Anything that they do is all about money. I mean, and the loyalty that we have is not about money. It's just about love, period. So it's a totally different dynamic.
Long-term listeners here on the Game of Crimes, they're used to hearing me talking about the law enforcement culture, the brotherhood and the sisterhood. And I was talking to a previous guest, Terry Sayer, who was on a couple weeks ago, and was telling me, even as a rookie cop, I was in Southern West Virginia, and two Charleston, West Virginia police officers were killed in the line of duty, and I went to their funeral, and I hadn't been a cop very long, maybe a year or two at that point. I got tears running down my cheeks. I never met these guys, but it's just that they're part of our group, our gang, I guess.
Absolutely, man. It doesn't matter whether you were best friends with them or whatever. It's just, once you're part of that circle or family, it's like, that's it. And that is, man, it's a tragedy. Anytime somebody is lost, you know, and, you know, I think you touched on this earlier about the mental mindset. It's like, I think one of the saddest things is, like, I've been on the job 34 years. I think I personally knew 5 guys that took their lives, ATF agents that took their lives while on this job. And that, to me, is the tragedy.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And just one last thing, I want to give a shout out to what I refer to as our unsung heroes, and that's our families, because we expect them to keep everything running at home. Same, you know, you've got kids at home with your wife and you're going on these long-term undercovers. Yours were more involved than most police officers. And the family's sticking there with us. I don't know why. You know, my wife's been married 42 years now, and I don't know if she feels sorry for me or what.
I always joke now, my kids and I joke about it all the time now, but one of my sons, I'd be gone like 90 day, 120 days. And I come back and I'd be like, hey, and they, by this time they're teenagers or whatever, they're in high school. I'm like, hey, do you miss me? And remember, he looks up at me and he goes, I didn't even know you were gone. At some point, man, they get their own lives going, but it's true. You know, your family and all that stuff. It's just, like I said, man, you can get caught up in this life. You can definitely get caught up in it, man. And it just, sometimes it can take you over.
So, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to know more about John Carr, good luck finding out. because I cannot find him on social media anywhere.
You're right. You're 100% right.
Oh, it's I told John before we started recording yesterday that when Javier and I retired from DEA, you couldn't find us on social media. There was one transcript of where we spoke at DEA's auditorium in Washington about the Escobar case, and somebody transcribed that. So that's the only thing you can find out about us. But John has done an excellent job in maintaining his anonymity.
Now maybe I need to do something about my LinkedIn account. Maybe I need to actually get on there because they could find me there, but maybe I need to actually log on to it myself.
So that, and since you mentioned it, I'll tell everybody, he does have a LinkedIn account. It's under John Carr, last name C-A-R-R. There's one follower, and I just asked him if he would accept me as a follower. So it'd be two.
And I haven't responded to you yet. I saw it though. you'll be the first, Steve. You're going to be the first one. All right.
All right. Thank you, brother. John, it's been a hoot, man. It's been years coming to bring you on the show. Thank you so much for everything you've done for our country. The sacrifices that you and your family have both made. You're a true American patriot. You're a hero. I don't care what anybody else says. The bravery that's required to do what you and some of your colleagues have done is truly going above and beyond the call of duty. So, brother, it's truly an honor to have you on here. Thank you.
And likewise, I feel the same about you. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it, brother. You're a good man.
And we'll have a little bro love after we hang up, everybody. So,
absolutely.
For all of you folks, here's a perfect example of why we have the Game of Crimes, because you would have never heard, you would have probably never known anything about John Carr, retired ATF agent, and all the fantastic things that he's done. That's not movie, that's not a TV script. That's a man sucking it up and facing death in the face. And by the grace of God, he's still here today to tell us about it. What is all that? That's part of the reason that you come back every week to play the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's our Game of Crimes. God bless you. God bless John. Be safe out there. See you next week.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to FinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.